Yeah, we're on stage. We're at the Wilkes Climate Summit. And we're going to talk about climate. We're going to talk about a lot of other issues and just try to show how the friendships that we share from the left, from the right, from the middle are a beautiful thing. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
Okay. Quite the challenge.
There All right, John, let's start with you. I want to start with climate.
Sure.
Of course.
Yeah, it's warm outside.
Hoax or a real thing?
It's a real thing, but how we address it is something that we have to debate and discuss and figure out.
Yeah, okay. Shireen, hoax or real thing?
You can guess. I'm deep in real thing.
Yeah.
And I actually agree with this. I think one of the things that's really interesting about having done this show for so many years is that we really have gotten, I think, in the habit of, in the good habit of, spending time in places where we often have deep disagreement, but realizing that we actually more often have agreement about core problems and issues. It's just the solutions that feel the stickiest part to
us. Yes, yes. So that resonates with me in the political middle. Yeah. I worked at the EPA, you two know that. And I was taught there, you know, is the surface temperature of the earth rising? Yes. Is man contributing to it? Yes. Is there agreement about what to do about it? No. Shireen,
I have a good friend who's a professor down at the school down south.
Okay.
And
Westminster.
Keep going. There you go. And he talks about, you know, climate change, global warming is happening, but all we can do as scientists is say this is what's happening. It's up to society, the politicians, et cetera, to figure out what the public policy should be as a result of that.
Yeah. Shireen, solutions. What do you want to see from elected leaders? Let's localize this in Utah when it comes to climate. What do you want to see?
I mean, many things. I feel like John and I often talk about all of the above solutions. I'm really interested in solutions, I would say, that are in all of the above, that we are not subsidizing things that are intentionally harming our environment or industries that are dying, that have found a way to build power that we continue to invest in, even though it's probably time to move away from those kinds of investments in power.
You didn't say data centers, you didn't say coal, but I could see that's what
you
were meaning.
I'm talking about coal and data centers. but then I would
Did you mention drill, baby, drill?
Yeah. But I would also say this. I think what I think is exciting about this moment, though it feels a little late, is that we do have opportunities at the local, at the municipal, at the county, and then certainly at the state level to push on our leaders to make better decisions for our future. So I think we're going to talk a little bit about statewide, and we're certainly talking about the data center today, but I really would encourage you to be looking at what your local leaders are really doing to prioritize a comprehensive approach to whether it's water, infrastructure, thinking about the ways that climate change is really accelerated here and what we're doing about it here.
Yeah. John, do you have a favorite solution out there?
Well, I want to step back, big picture, and I'm assuming for most of this audience, many of them probably wonder, why don't those folks on the right or stuff understand this? Why don't they get it? And so I want to start from there, because from my perspective and various other folks, too often folks that are passionate and concerned about an issue maybe over-portray the threats and lose people in the process. The other side here is the sky is falling over and over and over again and just doesn't get it. I'm one of those, I'm passionate about fiscal responsibility, so think of Social Security. Well, they talk about in the next 6 years, it's not gonna be able to meet its obligations. And yet, so many people today just don't see that that's a problem. They don't understand, and that's only 6 years in the future versus something that's potentially, you know, decades in the future. Yeah. And so one, it's you gotta meet people where they're at. You gotta find some common ground to then discuss from things that they're concerned with, where to go from there. And I'm one of those that I come from the perspective, which is, okay, conservation is something that generally, in the long term, I save money. And so therefore, for me, starting from the perspective of, gee, if you get a tankless water heater, here's how you can save money. It's more upfront, but you'll save, you know, not just money in the process, less emissions and other things like that. And you go on and on down the path, but you gotta find something that they care about. And don't be so the sky is falling that they just go, it's fear-mongering. What's the point? I don't care.
I like your big picture. Do you have a favorite solution?
Well, it's a bunch of little solutions. That's what I gave, tankless water heater.
Yeah.
Is a small solution.
I guess I would just say, John, I appreciate what you're sharing here, but I will say what comes up for me is that it felt like we had really good momentum on the lake here. Then we had a lot of snow and kind of a wet year, and it felt like we lost momentum. So if we keep meeting people where they are, unfortunately, people keep moving where they are. And so I think that's why it's exciting to be in this room where we have so many people who are really thinking about this in really big global ways. I agree with you, though, there's this piece of the connection of communication. How are we telling the story? How are we connecting the dots? And how are we putting the right kind of urgency to get the kind of momentum that we need to address the crisis in front of us?
Yeah. So one of my complaints about this program, my co-hosts both know this, is that we get the left, we get the right, we never hear from the middle.
Okay,
because I end up facilitating so much that I don't get a voice.
What do you like? What do you want to do?
Well, reduce
auto. What is your silver bullet?
I want to reduce auto dependency. Now, I'm saying this.
What does that mean?
Well, I'm saying this as a commissioner. I represent Region 2 on the Utah Department of Transportation Commission. That's just a gubernatorial appointment I have. And so I'm all about investing in roads and helping with congestion and whatnot. But I know enough about the growth in this state, about how expensive infrastructure is, to know that we have to change land use, we have to develop active transportation, we have to develop transit even more than we have. And I would like to see that. And these days, with so much of our vehicles being electrified, it's a real greenhouse gas issue because of the way electricity is produced in this country and in our state.
And see, this is where I would push back.
Okay, because, let's hear from
because
the right.
Mobility is a sign of our economic vitality. And so telling people travel less, fly less, drive less.
That's not what she said.
I'm saying give people more transportation choices.
Well, but part of what I'm hearing, and I'm just saying what a lot of folks will hear is less.
Yeah.
Rather than how do you do more? And, and for the audience here, they probably don't know. I'm one of those weird conservatives that drives an EV. So I don't have any tailpipe emissions coming out of there in the valley. So
yeah, John, you did something interesting though. I made it a point with this audience today to make the point that it's not what you say, it's what you hear.
Uh-huh.
And you were just challenging me on that, yeah. Saying, Natalie, you're saying, you know, reduce auto dependency, but what I'm hearing
is this:
drive less.
Yeah,
but that's not what you're saying.
Yeah, but this is interesting because a big part of our problem in making progress, environmental progress, progress on climate, other things, is our communications. Sometimes we talk past each other. Do you see this on the left?
I do. I can also see one of my professors in communication that's sitting in the audience. So I just have to say,
we will get the scores afterwards.
You were
a comms
major, is that right?
I was, yeah. Okay. And I really do think this is an important part of it. But I actually think this is a place where I see incredible success and wild failure among our politicians. Mm-hmm. If you cannot tell a story that connects to people in real and visceral ways, you don't, as far as I'm concerned, you don't have any business in this work.
So this will embarrass Shireen, but pile on here with me, John. I do a lot of work in public policy. I've over a course of nearly four decades, hired a lot of people in public policy. Shireen has an undergraduate degree in performing arts, if I'm not mistaken. And I now tell people that that is a great degree for public policy, a theater degree, because you're great communicators.
It's kind of you to say. It's funny because I also always feel compelled to tell people I have two master's degrees, and when they say, what are they in? I say puppetry, but actually they are in communication, organizational communication and policy.
Yeah.
But yes, I appreciate that, and I just believe that the people I've been most inspired by, and frankly the times that I see our leaders in this very state failing the hardest, is when they, for me, start to insult people's intelligence, kind of go down this road of pettiness, or to sort of act like the problems that the Utahns are bringing forward don't matter in a way that's really dismissive. I can say our Governor Cox has been kind of doing a bit of this lately, especially around the data center. And I think he knows that was a mistake.
Yeah.
I think we have to be real about people's how intensely people's feelings drive their connection to politics and place.
You go, John.
I was just going to say, when I was in the legislature, I served there for a decade, the lobbyists used to complain because I'd say, well, show me the data. What's the data behind your argument? And they're like, well, can't you just let the emotion sway you? But my background is engineering, so I'm an electrical engineer, bachelor's, master's, and so I'm always looking at the data.
Yeah.
And then as a business guy, I'm looking at the data.
Yeah, fair enough. We have about 4.5 minutes in this first segment. Let's go data center, shall we?
Let's do it.
Oh, boy.
Which one?
How do I set this up? I'm going to do the Stratus Data Center in Box Elder County. What, 40,000 acres, 9 gigawatts at full build-out of energy. Oh, wow. This feels like on multiple levels.
A great thing.
No. On multiple levels, some difficult policy and communication missteps.
I agree. Yeah.
I mean, John, do you say that on the right?
Yeah, I think there's been missteps along the way. There's a whole lot of misinformation going on as well.
Yeah, that's a problem.
That is not
for sure.
Reality.
Like you think 40,000 acres and it's going to all consume that land, and right. when in fact and, there's going to be a lot of it undeveloped. I mean, just
right.
things
well,
like that.
You know, what's the connection to the energy grid, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And there's the, well, here's what we plan to do. Your plans always change along the way. Mike Tyson said, you know, everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face. So when you say, here's what we intend to do, that may not be reality at the end of the day. But you got to Shireen's point, you got to bring people along and help them understand. But you also have to understand the popular will doesn't just get to decide property rights of how somebody uses the property.
This is a challenge for Shireen. I mean, I'm just going to set it up as a challenge, not that you have difficulty doing it. But there's this state's gotten a punch in the face, I think, on this. Meaning it's caused a lot of acrimony and, you know, just public discord. In a gracious way, what would you say to our state decision makers at this point?
Oh,
that's
well,
the setup, as I'm asking, because you can be really critical.
I can be critical of it. Here's what I would say. I think that this is a moment, again, where one of the core complaints that I'm hearing from folks who are opposing this across the political spectrum is we don't understand why we need this. And the simple answer that I feel like, is it Kevin O'Leary, has given, is that we're in an arms race with China. Mm-hmm. So we're in some abstract competition around giant data centers, and thousands of Utahns have lost healthcare this year. People cannot afford a home. They are breathing air that is making them sick. They do not see water going to our lake. And you're telling me we can move mountains, well, I mean, maybe in this case, literally, to get this.
The university doesn't want to move the mountains. They like it right where it is.
I guess the mountains get to stay. But we're going to move as quickly as really, I mean, I don't know that we've moved faster. And what else we're going to do is we're going to change the rules so that you don't get to give, or the feedback that you give to our state engineer about this doesn't actually have to be considered. We passed a law around that. We're going to give tax exemption to the industries, like the items that are purchased for inside of that data center. They get a tax exemption for that. But do you for getting?
But we're focused on the environmental
question. Okay, but I'm just saying.
You and I totally agree on the tax incentive stuff.
I know the tax incentives. Yeah. They get tax incentives. How about you? How's your cost of living?
John, give us a response.
I wrap it up. I'll just say that I think if you cannot meet the moment and understand that that's what people, I feel like in this room, I don't know, I'm seeing a couple nods, not a ton, but if you cannot understand that that is the feeling that we have as Utahns, and to try to bridge some understanding, you are going to lose on this. You're going to lose again and again and again. So you got to understand what people are feeling and try to explain it to them. But I think people are smart enough to know that this is a boondoggle.
Okay. So, John, you get the last minute on this.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say, I think too many people are focused on, well, where's the compromise? Where do we meet in the middle? Yada, yada, yada. If we get a smaller data center, then, hey, we got to win. I would suggest that what we really need to be thinking of is not how do we compromise, but how do we go to the extremes and figure out a better solution? One of the concerns that people have is greenhouse gases and emissions. Okay, so how do we figure out how to reduce or eliminate those emissions?
And there is a path for that.
And there's a path for that. Okay, one of the concerns is about water usage. Okay, what's reasonable, what's not? I'll go this far extreme. If there's a solution with no water usage or a one-time usage and nothing else, a lot of people are going to feel much more comfortable of, okay, that's responsible, that's reasonable, versus, you know, something else. And rather than just getting fear-mongering and all upset about it, let's walk through the specific issues and see, are there ways to solve this?
Yeah.
Because a lot of time companies will want to solve it, especially if they can figure out in the long term, it's going to save us money and allow us to do business and be good neighbors. And I think there's ways to do both.
Let's take a short break. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gurbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned, everybody.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Shireen Gurbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
And I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. We are talking climate. I'm going to just give you lightning round, just a few questions from our audience here, and then we'll jump on to some other news. Sound good?
Great.
First one, what about the role of the media in creating the end of the world narrative around climate change? As scientists, we emphasize limits of data and uncertainty, but it's the media that exaggerates. John?
And so it's the media that undercuts the message, and this is why people start checking out saying, yeah, whatever, they're just, sky is falling again. Yeah. But they don't understand the nuance of the media versus Did it come from the scientists or not?
Yeah. Shereen?
I think this is an important piece of it. I do feel like this is why, you know, longer in-depth reporting is so critical, but it's getting harder and harder to access and harder and harder to support and fund.
Everybody wants it in a tweet. They want it in the headline.
We're sitting here in mid-May. The temperatures are hot. I know our governor's worried. A lot of us are worried about wildfires this summer. How do we meaningfully balance carbon reduction programs when catastrophic wildfires can release emissions that offset years of man-made carbon savings? I'm thinking of like what happened in California.
These are some of the questions that I get kind of spun up about, right? Like when we talk about what's happening with water in our community, and then people say, oh, shower less or whatever while we build these gigantic data centers, right? So there's this sort of difficulty in thinking about what your personal responsibility and role in all of this is, and then thinking about sort of the broader or these big cataclysmic events. I don't know, but I guess my guess is someone here knows, but go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say this is where sometimes we've gone too far to say, okay, we don't want to touch the forest. We want the forest to be all natural. And then we get these wildfires rather than saying, well, we can do smart management. We can log. We can leverage that. We can keep the forest healthier and reduce the risk of wildfires. And yet we've gone to, I'll point to California. I moved here from California. But they go to the extreme and pretend like we won't do any of this and then forget about the massive, massive environmental impacts because of poor forestry.
Very good. Okay, we're going to shift.
Okay.
We're going to shift and talk about, my co-hosts know this, I love it when we don't have to talk about President Trump, but we have to do a little bit. He's going to China this week.
Are we talking about the carbon footprint of flying there?
Okay, or just the carbon footprint of the coal-fired power plants they keep building.
So many high-powered officials and business folks on the same plane.
Yeah, Shereen, are you expecting any kind of grand bargain, any kind of big news to come out of China?
I'm sure there'll be big news with probably very little results for the American people.
Okay, John?
I think it's important we need to talk with China, but I do think they're our greatest economic threat and potentially military threat, and I don't see that much coming out.
Okay, I'm with the two of you. A lot of people think China right now feels emboldened, partly because of their critical minerals standing, partly because of their supply chain dominance.
Is it because of their very large data centers that are so much bigger than ours?
Fair.
That too.
And then also this interesting dynamic about the Strait of Hormuz and all of the oil that's supposed to, you know, that would be going to Asia, how that affects China.
On how China is.
And then China funding some of what Iran's doing. John, you look like you want to speak.
Well, no, it's just they're funding, they're providing materials, weapons, et cetera, to Iran. So, you know, it's one of those threats. And it's the question of at what point does it get too close that we need to take more aggressive action? And I know China is loving watching how the U.S. is responding, not just in Iran, but with Ukraine as they eye Taiwan. And we have heavy dependence on Taiwan, and if China took it, we have other serious issues.
Yeah.
And you talked about rare earth elements. I mean, this is one of those things from an environmental perspective. I think we can harvest them, extract them more environmentally sensitive here than China will. And yet, for some reason, we were naive at just letting China just kind of dominate the industry and do everything as we protect our environment here and crippled our economy from my perspective.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting week for sure. I want to transition now to the economy. And
okay.
Now, the Strait of Hormuz still being compromised continues to make this war longer. This is one thing that economists all agree on, is the longer this
is
lasts.
Is it a war?
Well,
is
the worse
military
the impact.
Action? Is it a skirmish?
Yeah, I'm going with war, but the longer, the worse the impact on the economy. Americans are feeling this. We got bad price data this week.
Inflation?
Yeah.
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 So I feel like we've been through so many interesting economic times. We did this podcast all through the pandemic. When you think about what we experienced, let's say during the pandemic, and what we're experiencing now, are there parallels? Yeah. Are these divergent?
Yeah, I think they're divergent. I see the pandemic as very much a one-off, very unusual, a short pandemic recession that was very deep but short. Then the recession before that, the Great Recession, long and deep. This, what I'm feeling here is more like an exogenous shock that is more like the, you know, an imbalance created during the dot-com imbalance. Yeah. Okay. We'll get other economic news this week, though, because, go ahead.
But I'm just going to say, you know, with the midterm elections coming up and everything else like that, I mean, a lot of people are going to be concerned about what is the impact and how that's going to result in the election. But at the end of the day, if Iran is no longer a massive state sponsor of terror, with a threat with nuclear weapons, it will be a price that's well paid.
Yeah.
But if not, people are going to be very upset.
I think as much as, I'm not saying I necessarily disagree with you, but when we talk about meeting people where they are, which has been a little bit of a theme today, if they're still at the gas pump and seeing the prices, if food continues to rise because of the impacts on fertilizer, all these things, that is what they will be thinking about. Mark, nobody is going to be thinking, thank goodness Iran is not such a threat.
It's headed north of $5
a
gallon. Just mark my words. I think, I mean, in Utah, I realize it's already higher than that.
I drive an EV. I don't really notice.
Well, John, you gave me the excuse to ask this question. Redistricting comes up again. Virginia, you know, their court on technical reasons, not accepting those maps.
Multiple states in the South.
It's looking like the Republicans are getting quite an advantage off of this mid-year redistricting. Shireen, do you think it changes the midterm results? Like,
yes.
Right now, okay. Because yeah. I think the House still goes to the D's.
But I think what we've learned in this state is anytime you get to pick your voters, it changes the results. Now we're going to see that across this entire country.
Okay, John, what are you seeing? Because the question becomes,
in terms of seats created,
after the midterms, does the House swing and does the Senate swing?
In terms of seats created right now, Republicans have an advantage. But in terms of where the economy is and the sentiment of voters, I think it's
an
uphill battle for Republicans to maintain control of the House.
Yeah, good point. We're going to get this week a new Federal Reserve chair, I think, in Kevin Warsh. I think that Jay Powell, I think his term expires like on the 15th, so it's done this week. And I think they'll get Warsh confirmed before. I think this is good news for our country that we're moving forward and that there's not some elongated, you know, scandal with the current Fed chair and all that.
And do you have concerns about his ability to do this in a way that protects us through this uncertain economic time driven by our out-of-control president?
Yeah. I'll give you a stat on Jerome Powell. So he'll finish his chairmanship, but he could still be on the Fed.
On the board.
Yeah, for over a year or more. Okay, this is a little off script. I want to talk about the 2028 governor's race. You guys game for that?
I'm ready.
Already? Already.
Well, here's why.
Natalie, are you announcing? I'm 100% behind you.
Natalie for governor?
Don't do that. Don't do that. You're terrible.
This audience
here
loves
she
it.
Won't do it. She
here's
doesn't want to do
I
it.
I want to go to you, John, because you've spent so many years on Capitol Hill. How soon does the governor's race start to become evident to the public? I have my own answer, but I want to hear yours.
A couple months ago, Jason Chaffetz is actively out there courting people all over Facebook, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay,
so a couple months ago.
Okay, I was going to say January, so he's ahead of me.
Yeah.
This is so typical of a Utah Republican, which I am. I made my list of potential candidates, and I didn't include a single Democrat, and I told Shireen, I'm so sorry. So you're going to have to fill in the D's, but here's my list.
But you're saying those that will get elected.
This is just these are the names being floated. And what
keep
the reason this
centers.
Is evident
we'll
this week
goes.
Is that Politico did an article on our Senator John Curtis potentially being a candidate. So Lieutenant Governor Henderson, Speaker Schultz, Blake Moore, John Curtis, Jason Chaffetz, Spencer Eccles, that's the junior, Jeremy Andrus, who's the head of Traeger Grills, Phil Lyman. That was my list. You better add some D's.
Okay, well, we have a really interesting, because we actually have fair maps for the first time, so we've got a really wonderful cohort of candidates, some who have dropped out for different reasons.
I'll note my objection. Keep going.
I just
made the point that there are no maps at the gubernatorial level because it's the entire state, but keep going.
But we've had some good candidates, I think, get in the mix there. So I think Kathleen Reby is an excellent candidate. Certainly, I don't know what's going to happen in this primary, but Ben McAdams kind of, just seeing how things go. But I would also say that this, I feel like, is a really good opportunity for Utah Democrats to really get out there and talk about what it means to continue to have unilateral control, a supermajority in the legislature, a governor who's largely been, whose power has largely been curtailed by our legislature, to have an attorney general, an auditor, everyone else. No one there is in the opposition party. And I think that it is good for Utahns when we have a diverse voice in leadership to help hold others accountable. And so I would just say, I think this is an exciting time and it's a good time for us to tell a big story.
John, I want you to react to that.
One of the challenges for the Democrats in this state is the National Democrats and their progressive push that doesn't fit with so many Utah Democrats. They view themselves much more as moderate. And they sometimes look at D.C. and go, what kind of craziness is going on?
Wait. I got to say,
that's not us.
That fits Utah. But Utah Democrats turn out for Bernie. Utah Democrats turn out for Elizabeth Warren. Like, as a body, Utah Democrats that show up at convention are far left.
At convention.
Are progressive.
At convention. But I'm saying the general electorate.
Yeah.
You'll see in a primary,
okay,
what you'll see in a general election is very different than you generally see at the conventions. both on the left
yes.
and the right.
Yeah, but I want to make a provocative statement as our time is running out here. I think this is the most consequential governor's race of my lifetime in Utah.
Yeah.
Really?
I do.
No, it's that will come back in 2028 and double check.
It's yeah. because of the state of our world, the state yep. of our nation, and it's because, you know, 8 years ago, whatever, Cox, Huntsman, they both were great. I could live with either of those governors. But what's happening now is we're going very personality-based at a time in institutional decline. I'm worried. Give you both the last word. What do you think?
I think we need leaders who can meet the moment, and we don't have them right now.
I'm also going to say institutions matter. And we're going through a cycle where we're tearing down our institutions.
And I'm going to say we have the leaders to meet the moment if we will find the right one and elect them. This has been a great program, John Shireen. Our program is produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.